I had previously studied the poem, but the more I immersed myself in it, the more I marvel at your creativity in describing a Lithuanian gaon whose greatness on first impression expressed itself only in intellectual achievements, as in reality being a multidimensional towering personality filled with fervor, passion, and soulfulness. Congratulations. And then at the end he puts a little P.S. In Tzemach Atlas, which was the Yiddish title of what eventually became known as the Yeshiva, in English, the book, you describe Yom Kippur twice. Also in your book on the destruction of Vilna, it's the book called My Mother's Sabbath Days, Der Mamas Shabbosim, you mentioned that your mother, Zal, would go home on Yom Kippur afternoon to feed the cat. A moving story, indeed. Im Yirtz Hashem, in the course of the next... This book, as I said, came out last year. It was the fourth in a series of projected 10 volumes in the series called Me'otzar HaRav, which is the manuscripts that have not been published of the Rav. Another book came out after my book by my good friend Dr. Michael Berger on the ethical something of man. I don't remember the exact title. And another 5 books are projected in the course of the next 3 to 4 years. On Tfilah, another book on Tfilah, book on Talmud Torah, and some other manuscripts. I've begun working on a second book. I don't know if it'll ever come out. Because for it to come out, the criterion have to be loosened a little bit. And I'm not sure the family is ready to do that. But I do believe that the major writings, the communal writings of the Rav, have been published. Meaning the major, I don't think that we're going to discover any 40-page magnum opuses anymore. The major letters have been published, the major tshuvot have been published. But there's still many beautiful little letters that have not been published, some on some sensitive topics, like, for example, an episode that is not well known in modern Jewish history. In 1955, confidential secret negotiations were held between the Rabbinical Council of America and the Rabbinical Assembly. The Rabbinical Council of America is the rabbinical organization of the modern Orthodox rabbin in America. The Rabbinical Assembly is the organization of conservative rabbis. And the goal was to create a joint bezdin, to create a bezdin that would oversee all gittin and kiddushin of all conservative and Orthodox rabbis in America, as well as all gerusin. And if this had been successful, there would have been an unbelievable, meaning for it to have been successful, everyone would have had to sign on and present. Every get in America would have had to have gotten the approval of this bezdin. And according to the protocol, which you can find in the archives of the RCA and in the archives of the RA, the final protocol, before it was supposed to go to final acceptance, it said that the members of the Bezdin would be appointed jointly by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik and Professor Saul Lieberman. And they would only be appointed, members of the Bezdin would have to be acceptable to both parties. Which would mean, in effect, that the people that would have been appointed would have been all Shomrei Torah and Mitzvahs and would have been acceptable to every... I mean, basically, it was giving the Rav a veto, in effect. And so, Lamaisa, it would have been a way of ensuring halachic acceptability of all gittin and kiddushin and all gerusin in America under this rubric. Unfortunately, it fell at the last stages, it fell apart. Part of the reason was Professor Liebman, Olav Hashalom, felt that he could not deliver guaranteed 100% acceptance of the conservative rabbinate that they would sign on to this. There are other parts of the story that are still clouded in mystery. But the fact is, at some point, the Rav was in favor of this proposal and encouraged his representatives to pursue it. And we have some letters about this. So this is one interesting historical episode that, again, it never happened. Who knows what would have been the course of American Jewish history if it had happened? Who knows what would, you know, what things would look like today? But it didn't happen. So these are the kinds of interesting things that still need to be, so to speak, unearthed and done research about. There are other letters to individuals. And also, from time to time, I've spoken about this. Rabbi Moshe Kelman reminded me I had spoken about this once before. I actually spoke about this topic twice before. And once where I spoke in Long Island about it, after my talk, a woman came over to me and said, you know, my father was very close to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I have some letters. Would you like that? You know, like, so part of what happens is that you find, as you go through and you keep meeting people, more and more stuff gets unearthed. And so maybe there'll be a second volume one of these days, but I'm not sure. So that's what I wanted to share with you this evening. If you have any questions, I've certainly have time for questions and comments that you'd like to ask. Okay. I'll repeat the question so everyone can hear it. The question is, when are the Rav's tapes going to see the light of day? So the question is, which tapes are you referring to? Right now, there are the Rav, let's put it this way. Until the early 50s, there were no tapes. The Rav would transcribe many of his shiurim. He transcribed all in advance, all his major yortzeit shiurim, tshuva drushas. He transcribed them by hand, and we have the manuscripts of them. At a certain point in the early 50s, the Rav started to tape his daily shiur on reel tape, etc. And he continued to do that till the early 80s. In addition, there were tapes of the public lectures, of occasional shiurim and stuff like that. Most of the public lectures that the Rav gave, yortzeit shiurim, or many of them have, the tapes are extant. There's a fellow in Queens, you can go on the internet, and you can get most of those tapes. You can get hundreds, if not thousands, of tapes, some of better quality, some of worse quality. The reason why is because the Rav was, especially in the 50s and early 60s, was very makbid, was very careful. He didn't want people taping it and using it for their own purposes. And so people surreptitiously taped it under the table, under the coat, under this, under that. So it wasn't always the best quality. But some of the tapes are excellent quality. There's a fellow, as I said, in Queens, Nordlich. And many of those tapes you can get for yourself. The tapes of the daily shiur, some of them exist. Some of them have been ruined over the course of time, humidity and other things. And some of them have been lost. Nobody knows where they went. Some people want to make a whole mystery out of it. There was a big fight about it. I don't know anything about it. I wasn't involved, thank God. And so the better to stay out of those kinds of internal family feuds. I don't think that those tapes are very significant in terms of lumdus, because they have, many of them contain the daily shiurim. But at the same time, we have many of the notes of the prominent Talmidim from the 50s and 60s available. And people are starting to publish, based on those notes, on different mesechtot, on different tractates of the Talmud that the Rav gave shiur on. But I would actually claim that if you sat down and did a bibliography, you'll find that much of, the Rav's Torah is already in print. Between the Yortzeit Shiurim that the Rav actually wrote, the Kuntrasei Shiurim, the pamphlets of Shiurim on Avodas Yom HaKippurim and other things that the Rav approved of, actually went through and approved, that were written by his students. In addition to all the posthumous material that's been published by his students, like Rabbi Schechter, Rav Lichtenstein, and others, Rabbi Ganak, and others, the vast majority of the Rav's Chidushim are out there. They're not just not in one place in Gemara. A lot of the philosophy, the major philosophical works, are already in print. A lot more, as I said, is coming out. Already has come out. 5 books have come out, another 5 books. I think by the end of 2010, 90% of the Rav's writings will have been in print. And his major themes will be accessible, again, not necessarily from Kli Rishon, directly from his pen, but 90% of the things that he said and wrote will have been, are in the public domain. I don't think that's so bad. It's much better than it was in the 60s when people said there was nothing in writing, there's nothing. Questions? Yes. Right. Right. This is a very interesting debate. You're 100% correct. In formal terms, most Rishonim, most medieval commentators believe that in the absence of a Sanhedrin, in the absence of a formal designated court that has official powers of smicha going back to Moses, that the binding nature of any psak is, there's no such thing as binding nature anymore. You ask somebody a shaila, you know, you're asking them as an expert, but they don't have the binding force upon you as, you know, the Sanhedrin did. There were some Rishonim who disagreed. There were some Rishonim, the Sefer HaChinuch is the most prominent amongst them, who say that the principle of Lo Tasur, Asher Yagidu L'Chayamin U'Smol, you're not allowed to deviate from what they tell you, light, left or right, which is generally understood that you have to listen to the Sanhedrin, applies to the sages in each generation. That's the position of the Chinuch. Now, what does that mean, the sages? Does it mean the consensus? Do you go and take a poll? How exactly do you determine that? Unclear. But the truth is, most Rishonim rejected the Chinuch, and most Rishonim said that Lo Sasur, the prohibition on formally violating the decisive demand of the Sanhedrin only applies in the time of a Sanhedrin. It doesn't apply to any rabbi as great as they are. That's correct. At the same time, the fact is that in many areas of life, especially when it comes to strict halacha, many of us, we're knowledgeable, but we're not super knowledgeable on everything. There are things that I know that I feel comfortable paskening about, and there are other things that I'm totally out of my league. And so I turn to a colleague who's greater than I am, just like a doctor. You know, an internist may know some things, but hopefully, if it's a very serious issue, they turn to someone who's has much greater expertise. And so in that sense, when it comes to halachic matters, certainly, it's not binding in the absolute sense, but it certainly makes a lot of sense that you turn to someone great. In non-halachic matters, then you get into the whole dicey issue of Das Torah. And I agree with you. We in the modern Orthodox community generally don't believe in Das Torah in the sense of absolute binding nature. We believe that it has an advisory role. If you're not dealing with specific halachic questions, but you're dealing with questions that intersect halacha, public policy, social policy, it may be worthwhile to get the opinion of a great sage, but it's not necessarily binding. And certainly when you're dealing with purely political matters, who to vote for, what, you know, what economic policy the state should adopt or what, the idea that, you know, a great rabbi has any better insight than somebody who writes in the New Republic or the Washington Post is fallacy. So, did I answer your question? Totally disagree with you. There's no such thing. I agree with you that. I agree with you that today there are many, and we generally have decided to accept upon ourselves in the traditional community the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch as binding. But it is simply incorrect to say that we follow everything the Shulchan Aruch says. Because if that were true, you and I are right now both violating an Isser Doraisa. Because my peyot are too short, according to the Shulchan Aruch Psak, and your peyot are too short, according to the Shulchan Aruch Psak. The Shulchan Aruch says it has to be over here, below the bone. And both of us are violating. But why? Because we don't follow the Shulchan Aruch, because there are many other great rabbinic authorities who don't paskin like the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is a chumrah in this issue. And that's just one simple example of many areas where normative, traditional, orthodox, whatever term you want to use, practice, does not follow the Shulchan Aruch. In general, yes, we have come to accept upon ourselves the Shulchan Aruch. But there are many areas where poskim subsequent to the Shulchan Aruch don't feel bound by the Shulchan Aruch. Their tshuvas left and right. In Hungary, less so, but in Lithuania, left and right, poskim who would disagree with the Shulchan Aruch when they felt it was necessary. In a way that they would never have done against an explicit psak of the Gemara. So, to put the Shulchan Aruch in the same category of the Gemara, it's nice. It would be nice to say that, but it's not the reality of how halachic process works. Does that mean that the Shulchan Aruch is not the main guide of how Orthodox life is? Of course it is. But it doesn't have the same binding nature as a psak of the Sanhedrin or some conclusion, definitive conclusion of the Talmud, which all of Klal Yisrael accepted. So, again, we just have to be careful in our formulations. So, yes, I agree that in general we follow the Shulchan Aruch, and also the Shulchan Aruch doesn't cover every case in life, etc. Questions here?
Were there any letters that were intentionally left out of the book other than according to two criteria as you described at the beginning?
There were, I would say, one or two letters that probably did not fall into the uncriteria and yet were left out because they felt would be misinterpreted. I fought with the family to include those letters. There was actually three or four. On two of them I won, on two of them I lost. They had the final say. And so, you know, they have the final say. It's the family. The family approved the book, which avoided any controversy in terms of, you know, some of you may be aware, there was a controversy about publishing the letters of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg a number of years back. Personal letters where he is very sharp critiques of numbers of individuals. We don't have any letters like that. But number two, there you were publishing letters. He didn't have any children. So it was unclear. Would he have approved the publishing of these letters? There was nobody to ask. So it was a whole big controversy. But here, every step of the way, once the family decided, you know, they saw every word of the manuscript. They saw every word of my introduction. I wrote a 40-page introduction. They saw every word of my little introductions. And so, you know, that's as much as I can say about that. Yes?
Contradictory to known positions which the Rav held and created any problems?
No. I did not find... The Rav was very much Echad Bapev, Echad Balev. So I found letters where the Rav was very sharp against non-mechitza shuls, mixed pews, which corresponded very much with his public statements about it. I think the most interesting letter in the book, from my point of view, is the letter the Rav wrote in 1955 to Dr. Belkin Olav Hashalom, who was then the president of Yeshiva University, where he was asked by Dr. Belkin to review the smicha program at Yeshiva University. And the Rav wrote a very lengthy critique of what he felt were the gaping problems in the smicha program of the time. And what's interesting is that the Rav there has critiques of what we would call the classical Lithuanian yeshiva. On the other hand, you know, and I would have never expected the Rav to put into print the Rav who had written Isha Halacha, which is a peon to Rav Chaim and in many ways the classical Lithuanian yeshiva, and yet the Rav was honest enough in terms of what the practical needs of the American rabbi in 1955 were, that he felt that many of the models that were being used in Reitz and YU at the time in training rabbis were not effective. And he suggests a number of changes which were implemented. Not all of them were implemented, etc., etc., etc. I think that's the most interesting thing. But I never found, like, anywhere, you know, where the Rav, you know, said, you know, oh, yeah, you can have, you can, you know, you can use a microphone, you can, you know, you don't need a machitza, you know. I was just kidding about all that stuff, you know. No, there's nothing like that. There's nothing, no great revelations that I was just joking about, you know. Yes?
Particular very good letter that you couldn't tell us about that you left out of the book for reasons you weren't supposed to publish it, but you could speak
about. So I mentioned, I said, it was only two letters that I left out. So I said one of those letters had to do with the issue of the purported Bezdin between the conservative and the Orthodox rabbinate. So that's one letter that was left out. Again, the family felt that since it never came to be and it never happened, Lemaisa, it wasn't productive to put it. It would be misinterpreted, this, that. I mean, I argued, I said I didn't think that that was correct, factually. I thought it was an excessive concern. I think that it does a disservice to history. But, you know, I fought my battle and I lost. And I wasn't, you know, I obviously wasn't going to publish something against the will of the family. So one day it will be published, either in a book form or in an article form, but, you know, od chazon lamoed, as they say.
I'm curious why, from what I recall, when I read the book, and I must say, when I read the book, I called up Natty. You know, soon after I read the book, I said, well, the letter on the Smicha program is unbelievable, because the Rav talks about how you have to have an introduction in philosophy,
Tanakh,
and practical halacha, like, the total opposite of the Smicha program that I went to with YU in the 80s.
Right.
They didn't implement any changes.
Right.
I
so the truth is that in the 50s, they did. In the mid-50s, the Rav himself was involved, much more involved, in terms of that. And so, you know, he gave philosophy lectures in Revel and in the Smicha program. And there was Tanakh introduced. I think there was also some pushback. Some of the other rabbeim didn't go for some of the innovations. So what happened, there was a compromise. So they had tracks. Like when you were in Smicha, there was a track. If you wanted to do Jewish philosophy, you can do it. But it wasn't like obligated. Exactly.
Right.
So the Rav had a very grandiose vision that wasn't all implemented. And I think some of it was chipped away because there were other needs and other things happening.
I mean, I just, as an aside, I commented really, and this wasn't a plug, that I find the program you have at Chovevei really picked up, which is sort of the modern Orthodox, other Smicha.
We tried to some extent.
Really, their curriculum very much, I felt, like picked up on the program the Rav had outlined. But if you can just maybe comment, I don't believe there are any letters on the women's issues and the women's prayer groups in the 70s.
No, I looked high and low. The only, as I said, the letter that we have about women's education, I think, is very explicit about Talmud. No ands, ifs, or buts about that. There's no written material. Again, what's interesting, Bichlal, is that as the 60s wore on, I found less and less letters, which make a lot of sense. People wrote less letters. People who had contact with the Rav would talk to the Rav. People used the telephone. If in 1950 it was still a big deal that you had to, not everybody had a telephone in America, by 1970 everybody had a telephone. And so I think that many fewer people, the Rav was writing much fewer letters of that kind. Also, as he aged, it became harder for him. And I think it was much more an oral context in which the Rav dealt with people. The Rav didn't sit down. He had other pressures. And he was working on publishing his own material and other things. And by the late 70s, he was already, you know, stricken with Parkinson's disease. And, you know, which eventually, you know, got worse and worse, which made it even more difficult. So the last letter, for example, that I have is from 1977. And it's a very short letter. The bulk of the letters, the really good substantive letters, are from the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. By the late 60s and 70s, they're very short letters that I have. I don't have the long, discursive, substantive letters. So, and that's the answer to your question. When the women's issues, the first women's tefillah group, you know, in Boston started in, you know, the issues, you know, or the issue about women having hakafa was in 1973, 74. You know, it started in the, you know, all these issues came to the fore in the late, in the mid and late 70s and early 80s. And so by then the Rav wasn't writing letters about these things.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for the most interesting and informative. It's always important to realize our Gedolei Torah, like Matty pointed out, it's not just their learning and, in the Rav's case, his philosophical outlook, but his leader as a community and the personal insight to see how he cared for it. He had carried really the weight of Am Yisrael on his shoulders with concern for the entire Klal Yisrael, which is a wonderful quality we should all emulate. Thank you very much.
Have a good night.